We're going to talk in this panel about life after church discipline. We have a nice wide variety of panelists here with us today. Our first panelist is Levina Fielding Anderson. She was excommunicated as one of the September 6th in 1993. She continues to attend church. She participates in her local ward. I believe she still plays the piano in Relief Society.
Yes, and excommunication did not confer on me the ability to do it any better.
Oh, okay. Okay. And she is also an editor. She's also still collecting stories of ecclesiastical abuse. And her email address is elevina.
No, I'll do that part.
Okay.
That's wrong.
Okay. Okay. Our second speaker is Janice Griff Ryrie, and she is a convert to the gospel. She is an active Mormon who lives in Stansbury Park, Utah. She lives with her husband and six children there. She is a registered nurse by profession. Our third speaker is Flip Johnson. And what he brings to the table today is a lot of life experience. He served a mission where he lost his faith, and then through a combination of incidences, it resulted in his excommunication. And then we have Ricky Stedman, who's going to go last. He's known as Zion on the Richie T., the producer of the Mormon Voice of X96 popular radio show From Hell show, and he also serves as the X96 marketing director. He also hosts the Culture Hall, and we'll go ahead and proceed, and we'll start with Levina.
Okay, I've got 10 minutes, and I want to spend the first one saying that Bob Rees got us off to a wonderful start with his devotional this morning, and followed by the hymn singing session that we did in... Is the sound not working?
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That Fred Burroughs facilitated for us. And since some of this will be looking back, I want to start with a statement of looking forward. And it's a hymn from the new... Now, Community of Christ hymnal. You know that ours dates back to 1985, which is before some of you were born. But this one is brand new this last year. We thank you, O God, for our prophets who guide us in witness today. We thank you for sending the gospel and lightening our minds with its rays. We thank you for every blessing bestowed by your bounteous hand. We lift up our promise to serve you, to bring healing and peace to all lands. When dark clouds of trouble hang o'er us and threaten your peace by our fear, there is hope smiling brightly before us, and we know that your kingdom is near. We doubt not your grace and your goodness. We've claimed them in days that are past. And all those who labor for Zion will surely be blessed at last. And then pay attention to this third verse. A people God calls to be prophetic will walk in the way of the Christ, welcome all who would join in the journey, seeking joy in God's life-giving light. By prayer, may we always be open to hear further truths God would give. We dare to act boldly for justice and serve so that others may live. So when it's time for a new hymn book, it's over time, but when it actually happens, I hope that we come up with a revision of We Thank Thee, O God, for Our Prophet that is as beautiful and as forward-looking as this. Now, I want to make it clear that my statement today is personal. I am not claiming that mine is the right way to do it. I've chosen to be a disciple of Christ using Mormon forms to the extent that's necessary. There are many, many options, and I value and honor and respect all of those options. So this is a very personal statement. I'm not implying that my experience comes even close to covering the possibility for life after church discipline. Even though my excommunication dates back 21 years next month, events of the past few months have brought very painful memories to the fore, and I have felt literally heavy-hearted, a pressure in my chest, a literal ache in my heart as I've prayed for Kate and John and Rock and all the other people I don't know who are affected by the ripples of fear that something like this happens, when something like this happens to a community. I've also prayed for grace to forgive those who have made the decisions to discipline and for those who have been handed microphones or who have seized microphones to explain the church's actions. I want to share my insights about the two main words in our title, life and discipline. First, life. It's been my experience in speaking to scores of people who find themselves in situations where their faith is changing that one of the least helpful things they can do is to equate the church with God. It's a very easy and very natural mistake to make, and the church itself fosters that belief. But it is a dreadful mistake. Conflating the two means that the decision to leave one, if that is the decision, also requires abandoning the other. If that is your situation, I sincerely urge you to find ways to disentangle the two. The most urgent and pressing problem is to clarify your relationship with God first, and then deal with your relationship with the church. Two scriptures may be helpful in thinking through this problem. The first is Jesus' statement, "I am come that they might have life and have it more abundantly." That's what Jesus wants for us. That's why he came to earth. That's the goal of his life, his mission, his death, and his resurrection. So one of the important questions to ask is this: is the church helping you have life? Is your life more abundant because of the church? I can think of three ways in which the church genuinely can mediate that more important life. First, it provides opportunities to serve, which can bring genuine joy and increased love. Second, it provides experiences with sacrifice that help us understand ourselves and others more deeply. And third, it puts us in contact with people who have sincere testimonies. We have plenty of the other kind, who have experienced God's love and who can provide steadiness and hope as we seek to experience that love for ourselves. But is the church the only way to provide these pathways toward abundance? Absolutely not. Service, sacrifice, and love are available to anyone who seeks them. The church can facilitate the abundant life in some ways, but it does not and cannot own those experiences. The second scripture is, "And this is life eternal, that they may know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent." Again, in several ways, the church can genuinely help us know Jesus. It can encourage us to read the scriptures, to associate with people who are trying to live righteously, encourage us to pray, and that also encourage us to seek a deeply spiritual, rich life. But the church does not own these activities either, and it can actually impede our knowing Jesus. To cite just one example, if we think that the four-part standard prayer is the only way we can express ourselves, then there are parts of our lives, angry parts, hurt parts, confused parts, even loving and joyous parts, that don't fit into that form. Another way the church can impede our knowing Jesus is that it can replace grace with works, so that we actually fail to recognize his love. I remember a young woman in our ward perhaps 20 years ago who was preparing to go to the temple for the first time, and she bore a fervent testimony about how happy she was when she held the temple recommend in her hand that told her she was worthy to enter the temple. I was shocked that her sense of worthiness depended on a piece of paper, not on what was happening in her own heart. One of the great comforts of my life is Nephi's testimony of the Lord's unshakable promise. "Oh, then, my beloved brothers and sisters, come unto the Lord, the Holy One. Remember, the way is narrow, but it lieth in a straight course before us, and the keeper of the gate is the Holy One of Israel." And then this is what I want to stress: "And he employeth no servant there." In mortality, we have to deal with problems and injustices that others can inflict upon us, whether as intentional abuse or just because we're all human and make mistakes. But in the relationship that matters most, our relationship with the Savior, he employeth no servant to represent him, no one who can stand between him and us. That's why I say that if you need to, disentangle the relationship between the Savior and the church in your mind. Excommunication tangles them again by labeling some as worthy and some as unworthy. One of my personal insights is support for the order the church has established about the relationship between stewardship and revelation. I have no problem with assigning responsibility for church-wide revelation to the men who hold the office of apostle and prophet. But I can't describe the pain I feel that those who claim the privilege of revelation seem to refuse the responsibility to seek it. Our church claims continuous revelation, yet it punishes those who implore its leaders to seek it. Some of the most horrifying statements and silences to come out of Kate's excommunication is the denial that there is anything to pray about or any point on which further revelation should be sought. I feel such longing when I read calls from Steve Veazey, prophet and president of the Community of Christ, for the whole church to join in a discernment process. What if our leaders similarly ask its members to pray earnestly about ordaining women to priesthood, about supporting and celebrating our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters who want to marry, have families, and participate in congregational life? What if our leaders really accepted Nephi's assurance and invited us to join with them in the call, "Christ denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female, all are alike unto God." Now for the second word in our panel's title, discipline. Church discipline is the Mormon form by which we can manifest sincere repentance for certain grave sins. I think that form can work for some individuals if the repentant person invokes it voluntarily. I think it stops being effective almost immediately when the process is imposed externally, when the person on whom it is imposed is accused, judged, and punished unjustly. I don't know what percentage of excommunicants return to the church, but I've heard anecdotally that it's very small. It's natural to feel anger, resentment, betrayal, and a loss of trust. I was talking with a friend about what it must feel like to people who sincerely and honestly consecrate what they feel their best gifts are to the church. And he said, yeah, when you put your gift on the altar, you really don't want the priest to spit in your face. And I think that out of all of the things that need to be healed in disciplinary actions, the last one to be healed, because it's the hardest and I think it never comes all the way back, is trust. I think that it is broken in ways that it can be partially healed, but never totally. But even though these feelings are natural, they're energy vacuums and they keep us engaged with corrupt and corrupting influences that accompany abuse. I think it's important to put our energy into self-discipline, to clarify our understanding of the gospel, to cling to the Savior, and to find forms of discipleship that will let us live abundantly. When Lowell Bunyan was fired from the Institute of Religion at the University of Utah because of his liberalism, he refused to strike back or take advantage of the many forums available to him to explain his own position. Instead, he responded, "Why should I be defeated twice, once by circumstances and once by myself?" I think he was generous in calling Ernest Wilkinson circumstances, but doing so did free him to step away from that abusive relationship. My time is up. I want to quote Pope Francis, who drew his homily on June 24th from the parable of the mote and the beam. He pointed out the scriptural fact that the title of Satan is the accuser. But then he said, Jesus will judge, yes, at the end of the world. But in the meantime, he intercedes. He defends. He is our advocate with the Father. And meantime, those who judge, who accuse, who bully, who cut off sincere discussion, who silence honest questions, who cast the sufferers out of the community, they claim to speak in the name of God. They may be among those to whom Jesus will say, depart from me, I never knew you. Or as the Joseph Smith translation reads, you never knew me. May we cling to Christ, be open to his grace, and have the blessing of being forgiven of our own trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Thank you.
I don't know what exactly is going on with you today, but that works out because I didn't ever prepare talks for church either. I'm here, I guess, as a perfectly mundane story of excommunication and apostasy. I totally had it come. But real quick, since we're talking so much about music and hymns, and I finally have a captive audience of people who are interested in Mormonism, because I generally hang out with, you know, apostates and other never-Mormons, just wish I wouldn't talk about Mormonism anymore. But, of course, I always loved my favorite hymn is If You Should Hide the Cold Love. And, of course, you never ever hear it. And mostly it's because it talks about Kolob, and that's kind of weird, and you always wonder if there's, you know, if there's investigators in the room, that might raise some questions. But I think the real reason you don't hear that song so much is that it's the only hymn in the hymnal that asks questions that aren't rhetorical questions. You know, everything else is, I know that my Redeemer lives. You know, you're never saying I have evaluated the evidence and believe that my Redeemer lives. You know, it's all, what child is this? That's the question, right? Well, the answer in the song, If You Could Have a Cold Love, it's the only one where it's like a Pink Floyd song almost. It's all these hanging questions, and they know that there are no answers, and the point is that we're just asking, which comes up a lot, obviously, asking questions from discipline. But to give you a quick sandwich of my life, I was born under the covenant, and I got a super big dose of both classic Mormon heritage narratives. Patrilineally, the Johnsons go right back to New York, 1831. They're peppered all over Mormon history. Almira and Delcina Johnsons, two of Joseph Smith's celestial wives, were my great-great-aunts. Nephi Johnson was a perpetrator at Mountain Meadows. Joel Johnson wrote the lyrics to High on a Mountaintop. You know, one of them hammered the roof line of the Kirtland Temple. One of them was a Danite, I found out, reading the D. Michael Quinn book. That was shocking. And then my mom was Brazilian, an immigrant, and she was part of that gigantic wave of converts that came out of Brazil in the 1960s. And she ended up coming to BYU where she met my dad, and that's how I came to be, and how I came to be a Mormon. And the other interesting thing there is that while my dad was basically a Jack Mormon, my mom was a rock of uber faithfulness. But my mom also was just a convert and real into religion and Jesus and not real into history and doctrine. Whereas my dad, you know, he told me, I grew up learning about Mountain Meadows and Blood Atonement and all this stuff. Before I went to the temple, my dad told me about the penalties because he didn't know they'd been removed. He had not been to the temple since the early 80s, and nobody had told him they'd changed anything. So I was weirdly shocked that I didn't have to do that. And I was kind of an inactive teenager that mostly associated with non-Mormons. I guess the Mormons just kind of bored me. I don't know. But I was always a believer, and I was a super depressed teenager, and unlike a lot of boys, I very much chose to go on a mission. That was something I absolutely needed to do. I thought that it would turn me into a happy man. I thought it would fix me. And I absolutely put my chips down. You go and do the things that the Lord commands, and the blessings will follow. Well, yeah. a lot of things happened on my mission, and I'm not sure exactly how to tell the story to get to the excommunication part. But when I was about three quarters of the way to my mission, oh, and all the stuff about Mountain Meadows and Blood Coma and knowing all this stuff was real handy, because I went on my mission in Northern California, which in the 80s was like the epicenter of the golden age of Christian anti-Mormon, all that stuff. Dr. Walter Martin, Dick Baer, and Ed Decker all operated there. I met Dick Baer. We broke the rules and went over to Dick Baer's house. You could tell what it was, because his license plate said ex-Mormon. So when I was out about 18 months, I sort of reached this point that I wasn't sure if the church was true. I thought that if any church was true, it might be the Mormon church. And if the Mormon church had ever been true, it had to be an apostasy or something. And I just carried on with my mission and struggled with this and was basically as faithful as I could be. And, you know, meanwhile, going through all kinds of emotional and psychological torment, a lot of messed up things, you know, that just ordinary things that happen on your mission just because mission president was an idiot. He's a nice guy, I love him, but he had no idea how to manage people. And he was clearly not talking to God. I can remember the very moment, actually, that my faith in priesthood authority evaporated. And it was at the end of a very long interview with my mission president. This was like 6 months into my mission. And I had a companion who was just having enormous troubles. He was completely illiterate, could not read, and had anger management issues, and everyone in the house was constantly packing and going home and making my life hell. And, you know, I've been doing this for a while, asking the president about, like, you know, I'm struggling, like, he gets angry, he throws things, we never leave the house, he takes off on me, like, what can I do? And I said at one point, President, I can't control how people react. And he said, well, maybe that's your problem, Elder Jones. And I need to learn to control how people react. And he smiled and nods. And I said, okay, President, let's pray. This is over. I'm not getting any help from you. And that was that exact moment I realized, oh, this guy's not talking to God. He doesn't know what's going on. He's an idiot. He's trying, just like I am, you know? It's the same as me. Anyway. I have to continue the story because at the exact same moment, if you can blame one man for my apostasy, it's probably him. Because at the end of this, you know, he says this thing to me. I say, let's pray. And we say the prayer. And I said, President, just one more thing. Because I had heard early on there were rumors that the president had brought his BMW Z3 with him to the mission field, which of course he wasn't supposed to do. And I, one day at the mission home, just to confirm it, went into the garage and saw it with my own eyes. And so at the end of this interview, I said, President, just one more question. That BMW, is that a 6 or an 8? And he said, what are you talking about, Brad Garrett? What are you talking about, Elder Johnson? I said, the BMW, President, is that a 6-cylinder or an 8-cylinder? I don't know what you mean, Elder Johnson. President, I've seen it. Is it a 6 or an 8? What's a cylinder, Elder Johnson? And so he's like, okay, so not only are you not talking to God, but you're also breaking the rules and smiling about it, just like us. All right. I don't know how to tell this story uber succinctly. At the very end of my mission, a truly bizarre, wild thing happened where basically a small cabal of local leadership got a bee in their bonnet that me and my companion had to be gotten rid of. And over a period of weeks, there was this bizarre campaign of them, like, fabricating things about us. And, you know, I nearly got sent home. The president actually offered to send me home early, honorably, just to get me out of the area, because my friend believed me that everything was ridiculous these people were saying. The bishop was spying on us, they were calling people, it was just bizarre. And granted, like, you know, I know this is not typical with Mormonism, you know, I mean, everybody sort of, oh, I was offended, this horrible thing happened to me, and you always go like, oh, I'm sure that's not how that happened. Sometimes those things happen. And it happened to me, and it all culminated in this moment with the president threatening to send us home. And the great irony was that me and my companion at this point, you know, we've been companions before, and we've been wicked by mission standards in that we watch TV and play PlayStation and listen to rock and roll. You know, no commandment breaking or anything like that. But we got together, and it was the very end of our missions. Both of us were leaving at the same time. We knew that. And we had this moment. We screwed around in the past. this is going to be different. We're going to work hard. And we're going to obey all the rules, and we put away all the music, and we sent the PlayStation back home, and we got down and were the best damn missionaries in the mission. Not only were we actually faithful and working hard and doing all the crap we were supposed to do, we were actually having success. And in the middle of this was this weird cabal of local leadership spying on us and trying to get us sent home, and literally lying about it, making things up to try to get us sent home. And so we got this moment where we got called down to the president's office. He tells us to pack up. We think we're going home. The president decides to send us back. And as we're walking into the apartment, and you know, my companion and I are just fuming the whole time, you know, and this is hours, because you know, we had to drive down there. A whole day was spent. We, you know, pack up our houses, no, go home. And we're just fuming mad. And we're walking into the apartment, and right at that moment, there's a guy carrying the TV down the stairs, and he says, "Do you guys want this?" And yeah, I'll take that. Because this moment broke down where we're just like, okay, you know, nobody's playing by the rules. The members aren't playing by the rules. We already know the president's not playing by the rules. And this thing kind of broke in us where, on the one side, we continued being badass missionaries, and in the mission lingo of what we call handling our junk, which is mission lingo for streetwise, which is do a good job while keeping being sane, but preserving sanity. But then we also started swimming in the big blowing bags. It's summertime, it's hot, and we play PlayStation all this. Anyway, a couple of girls start coming around to our apartment. And uber long story short, I sort of, in the last couple of weeks of my mission, end up kind of dating this lovely girl in the ward. And, you know, for me, it was a thing in part that, like, I never had any kind of temptation as far as I was concerned. This woman showed no interest in me that I could ever perceive. And, you know, it just didn't happen. And along comes this, you know, charming, beautiful girl who was 100% deep down on me, and I absolutely just fell in love, stupidly. And two days before I ship home from my mission, I end up sleeping with her, which was really dumb. But of course, the biggest mistake, I made a lot of mistakes in my relationship with that girl, but the biggest one was marrying her. But the reason I bring this stuff up is because, like, I got excommunicated for fornicating on my mission, which in Mormon terms, like, that's wow, right? Like, that's a bad, and yet, I didn't feel like a bad person. And, you know, I guess this is a university, I can talk about this stuff. I did not masturbate for 2 years, all right? People question my devotion and faithfulness. And how hard I was trying to do the things that God wanted me to do, right? You know, when I was real young, I used to imagine that, like, one day I would climb Everest or run a marathon or fly around the world alone in a balloon or something. But that part of me that, you know, you have to fight that battle with yourself and win it, I won it 700 days in a row. Right? You know, so, like, for me, like, it's kind of like, you know, I made choices, obviously. I fornicated with a girl while I was on my mission. But, like, to my perspective, I might as well, like, I've been hit by a bus crossing the street. That's how it felt to me. Like, I just got swept up into this tornado of this thing that happened. So I don't call my mission president because I know he's a jackass, and I'm just going right home to my state president, who is an awesome, awesome dude. And, you know, I'm still in my tag, all that stuff, just out of the airport. I go have my meeting with the state president. "Hi, how are you doing, president? I got something to tell you." And the look on his face, he was pretty crushed, because that was kind of the prodigal son even going out there. So right then and there, I think they just fellowship and do this three-man panel. And a couple weeks later, because, you know, the girl, she ended up moving out to Salt Lake right after that. A couple weeks later, I go back to high rise, and it happened again. And they convene the big thing, the 15 people and all that. And, of course, this whole time, I'm just in a black fog of depression, and what am I going to do, and what's my identity? And also, this thing, like, you know, excommunication is really big in the news right now, obviously. Like, and Kate Kelly, as far as I can tell, was excommunicated for insolence, because she's not an apostate. John DeLynn is an apostate, and the jury's still out on him, I guess. Right? Whereas, but what I did was to sit next to frickin' murder. But I'm not a bad guy. I didn't even jerk off for 2 years. I never went through any period when, most teenage boys go through some kind of period of antisocial behavior, shoplifting, breaking windows, that kind of thing. I threw one snowball at one car in my life, hit it, got caught, felt bad, lesson learned. Sounds like a kid I always was. And here I am with these 15 guys, and I know that I've done the 7th worst thing a person could possibly commit. But at the same time, I remember saying this to them and other people, my crime is that I fell in love. You know? I had to fight this thing of, my upbringing and everyone around me, I did the 2nd worst thing a person can do. But, I never walked around in the day having to resist the urge to kill that guy. You know? That's not a thing I struggle with. I don't have to fight the urge to steal stuff every second, you know? Where sexuality is a whole other thing, you know? I mean, before I fornicated, I just already felt bad enough for having sexual thoughts. And I was, perfectly ordinary and heterosexual. I was always into chicks my age, all bread and butter. And yet, I'm a terrible person, right? Because, I let this thing culminate to the point where I did the 2nd or worst thing a human being could do. So I also kind of got myself vexed, not just by making that mistake, but I don't remember a lot about the actual disciplinary council, but I remember basically not getting a defense, being very open about my struggles with faith, saying that I feel like my crime was that I fell in love. And I gave him no choice but to ex me. And I guess the theme of this thing is your life after that. I've often wondered, cheat rates kind of made me think about it. And I never thought about it before today, actually. Strategically, did the church do the right thing by exing me? Would they still have a member today if they hadn't? I don't think so. I think I was on my way out. But what the excommunication did for me was that, I'll tell you exactly my feelings at the time. Because, I'm in the room with the 15 people for an hour. I found out later that half of them are supposed to be on my side. They talk about church court, right? But it's not like they ever tell you what's coming. They tell you what the next phase is when it's happening, I'm in the room with the 15 guys for an hour. What about your covenants? Oh, I don't know. What about your faith? No idea. How do you feel about this next, Then they put me in a room by myself for half an hour where I have the dark night of the soul, which I think was really mean. They didn't need to put me in those. You know how a lot of those church classrooms are kind of prison-like to begin with, and they put yourself alone in there while 10 yards away 15 guys determining what happens to you after you die. And they pull me back in, and they've got a letter drafted on that you're excommunicated, and these are the things you have to do to get back into it, right? And I leave the stake center, and I drive straight to Walmart, and I buy an economy family-sized pack of boxer shorts. And I went home and took my garments off and put them all in a box. And that moment was one of the most religious experiences I ever had in my life. Because, people have asked me a lot at times, when did you leave the church? And for me, it's a complicated answer because I think my apostasy started when I was 12. I was excommunicated at 21. I left Mormonism emotionally by 23 and was an atheist at 25. It's a difficult thing. But that moment when I put the garments in the box, I felt this relief. And I had this moment. I have the best excuse ever not to go to church on Sunday. I'm not a Mormon. I'm not a Mormon. Out, and I think I went to church twice after that, and I did go to my meetings with my state president for 6 months every week, and I have to say, I'm running long here, but to counterbalance a lot of things, there's a lot of crappy leadership in the church. Everybody knows that. But I have to say that my bishop and state president were 100% awesome about everything, and even more so than they needed to be. But like 6 months into all these meetings with the state president, I remember saying, you know, President, I haven't turned my back on the church. I just don't want to do it right now. And he said, then no, you shouldn't. And that's the moment I felt right. I won't. And eventually I did turn my back on the church, only to say, like, I'm leaving, but I'll be back later, guys, to say hi. Because, you know, I'm an ex-Mormon by a lot of definitions, but I hate the term, because in the same way that if I went to another country and renounced American citizenship and never spoke another word of English, everything about me would betray my Americanness, and there would be no way that I could ever shake that. I'm a Mormon. I drink and smoke, and I don't believe a lick of it, but I'm absolutely 100% Mormon. It's the people I know, and they're my friends, they're my family, and I'm stuck with them. Like it or not, but I do like it. I love Mormons. And, I'm getting a signal, so I hope that made sense. Thanks.
And this is great. People are already leaving before I even started talking. See, that's cool. No, don't worry about it. I waited to speak, but that's fine. So I've got 4 minutes. Here we go. I know, we started late, and I want people to be able to ask questions, I think, too. So I really will go briefly. I had the opportunity to go through church disciplinary actions twice. Yeah, I've done that twice. Yeah, give that up. Woo! Yes. The first time I was disfellowshipped, for, as the church likes to put it, Levi Loving. And that's it. So then I found my way back. Yes. Normally you're disfellowshipped for a year, but I got to come back after 7 months. Have her explain to you what Levi Loving is. Anyway, and then... The second time I was disfellowshipped, not for having intercourse, but for almost having intercourse. So, should have done it really, but whatever. So that was, well, I should be serious about it, because it's actually something I take pretty seriously, but... Let me start over. I was born under the covenant. I served a mission in Cleveland, Ohio, which, for people who don't know, covers the Kirtland area. I had an opportunity to serve, not in Kirtland, but by Kirtland, but had the opportunity to have several church meetings within the School of the Prophets, which was an amazing experience. One time in Kirtland, this is where it starts to get kooky and crazy, but a companion and I decided to go running in the morning, and as clear as I'm looking at all of you, I felt like I saw the early saints of the church around the Kirtland Temple. I've had amazing experiences as far as the church goes, and confirmation, knowing that it's true. This disfellowship and an excommunication took place when I went to college after I got home from my mission. I was home about a year before I was disfellowshipped, and home about 2.5 years when I was excommunicated. At the time that I was excommunicated for almost having sex, I went into the bishop and I said, hey, this girl that I'm dating, we've been dating for 6 months. For the last couple of months, we've been able to be good, but I just feel like I want to clear my conscience and talk to you about it. And he said, I think we need to have a disciplinary council. So we went into the disciplinary council. It was a brand new state president and 15 gentlemen who didn't know me. I'm kind of a, I don't know the word to describe myself, whatever. Anyway, my phone number, this is pertinent to the story only because I think it's funny, my phone number in college was 590-LICK, and in college we had one of those placards that you put your phone number underneath you so the bishop could have it, and that was the only thing that these 15 men knew about me, was that my phone number was 590-LICK. So based on that, and the experiences that we then got to go over, they decided to excommunicate me. The panel's called Life After Church Discipline, and it was really terrible. I didn't care for it very much. I'm someone who, by character, you know, it's like, hey, this person needs to be moved, I'll move you. This person, you know, needs to be home taught, I'll home teach them. They don't want people to come around, well, I'm a religious guy. They'll want me to come around. And so for me to be excommunicated and not have the privilege to be able to participate in those things was really terrible. Sunday, every Sunday, go to church, even on vacation. I'm one of those guys. And so for me, that first Sunday after being excommunicated, I was like, that was the only time that I was like, you know what? They don't want me. I don't want them. But I ended up going. And I ended up going the entire time that I was excommunicated. I was excommunicated for 9 years. And in that time, similar, although I don't know if you did this, because a lot of people know that I'm Mormon and I kind of wear it, you know, on my sleeve, I had to search out white boxer shorts or white underwear that didn't have the name Haynes on the top in case I reached up and people could see, because I thought I would be embarrassed about that. So try finding underwear that doesn't say Haynes or Fruit of the Loom on the, you know, or the white t-shirt part is easy, but... you know, for a long time and for all intents and purposes, I'd be in church and people would ask me, you know, hey, can you pray? And I'm like, yes, I can, but not here. You know, can you talk? I would love to. Can you do this calling? Sure, if you can talk the bishop into it, you bet. And it was hard. It was a miserable experience. I think about it a lot as it kind of is mentioned all throughout the panel, as to why that has to be the way about it. And perhaps maybe counter to what everyone else will say, though, I know, even for as miserable as it's been, that it has been the path for me which I've needed. After I was disfellowshipped, there's three times in my life that I felt the Spirit the strongest, and after I was disfellowshipped, again, for Levi Love, and she's got a diagram, she knows what to do, was one of the three biggest times I've ever felt the Spirit in my life, knowing, hey, it's going to be okay. And second time was when I had my blessings restored under the hands of my state president. This was just a couple years ago. And it sucks. It sucks really bad. And hearing about other people being disfellowshipped, I don't think anyone knows what it's like unless you've done it, or being excommunicated unless you've been there. I don't like it. I see other people that are doing it, and I fear that those people won't stay close to the gospel and stay close to the church and be a part of it. But, you know, it breaks my heart to hear about those things. But for me, personally, and I can only speak for me, I know that I'm now more strengthened in my resolve. There's lots of things I don't understand. I don't know why it happened to me. I don't like that it happened to me. But I know that I would not be as strong as I am in my resolve to do the things that are right so that it never happens again because of it. So maybe I'll end on that. Are we doing questions? Are we doing this? Are we too late? Should I explain Levi Love? I'm willing to do that. Okay, so what happens? No, I'm kidding. No, I'm not going to talk about that. Have your grandkids tell you.
Is there questions? Are we doing that? Is that the thing?
Anybody have a burning question? Like the one question we're going to do today?
One burning question? Why 9 years?
What?
Why 9 years?
Oh, why 9 years? Because it was sexual indiscretion, right? Make poor choices that were almost sex. And ecclesiastical leaders, because I being a single person and being 26, I mean, you can only go for so long as he indicated, and then I kind of like the way that feels. God intended to have it that way. So then it was a thing where it was just like, well, okay. And I ended up getting married, and then it becomes okay. Right? Yeah, anyway.